Click kaya959.co.za.
This is how we do it.
To download the Point of View podcast.
Thank you so much for staying with us. It's, I would say, arguably one of our favorite features. So, in studio with us, we really are very privileged to be graced by Sipho Mahala, who is, as I said, in studio with us. Dr. Mahala, thank you for coming in. Good evening.
Thank you. Good evening to you and Kai FM listeners.
Okay, so what a treat. Not one, but two books that you're launching at the moment. Two plays that have been staged already, but I'm suspecting there's going to be more of this coming through. But the latest being The Missing Pages. It's a collection of short stories. Mm-hmm. I personally find your short story writing the best. I really enjoy your short story writing. I want to talk a little bit before we get to The Missing Pages. I want to talk about The House of Truth and The Bloke and His American Bunty, the two plays that you've now published. And perhaps what keeps you so interested in that era of South African history? We could speak about Bloke, we could speak about quite a few of the characters that you've studied as a scholar. But what fascinates you the most about that era in South African history?
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for the compliment about short story writing. Well, the 50s,
yeah,
is a period that fascinates me. It has happened organically, mm-hmm, through studying and exposure. But I think what I find intriguing about it, it's a defining moment for us in terms of journalism,
yes,
journalism, and also in terms of short story writing in South Africa. That's where really black writers express them a lot through short story writing, of course, with Drama Magazine being the platform.
Mm.
You know, so Ken Temba, Bloke Modisane come from that era. And it's no wonder that short story writing is one of my areas of interest.
Yes.
But beyond the short stories, I got interested in their stories because,
yes,
you know, if you look at the lives of Bloke Modisane and Ken Temba, both of them ended up in exile and in different countries of exile. And so largely their stories were told while they were in South Africa. We didn't know much about them the moment they crossed the borders.
Mm.
So that's been part of my interest to understand exactly what happened after they left South Africa.
I also think that part of obviously some of the work that you've delved into around the 50s in particular is just Sophia Town sticking for me like a sore thumb in an era where everything else doesn't make sense. But this really strange community of people are a strange model of what's possible if you allowed people to just coexist. And and yes, it's got its tensions, but it's also a beautiful way of exploring what a society perhaps could look like when class is not such a thing, race is not such a thing, a melting pot of different cultures is not a thing, if you just allow people to be.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the thing about Sophia Town, that it was a very small community.
Yes.
Yet it was, you know, it was noticeable,
yes,
because of its uniqueness,
yeah,
that people across races could buy land.
Yes.
It's one area where black people could buy land next to and become neighbors,
mm,
you know, across races. As you know, that after that, the Group Areas Act was implemented trying to destroy that culture.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sophia Town was that vibrant culturally, politically.
Mm.
That's why you find that guys like Bloke Modisane, Ken Temba, Mphahlele, all of them stayed in Sophia Town.
Mm.
They were together in the newsroom, all right, and outside the newsroom, they still gather together in Sophia Town, and also musically, some of our most prominent musicians from the 50s lived in Sophia Town.
Yeah.
The same applies to politics.
Yes.
Some of the political leaders who came from elsewhere, you know, settled in Sophiatown. So it was that vibrant community where you could find just about anything.
Not to necessarily isolate the 50s as only being the time when you really could pick out the sophistication of intellect in black people that was explored by others because it was published, most importantly. But I think for me that's also quite an interesting time for us as Africans, where excellence in writing and storytelling was explored, yes, with limitations of not being afforded the, because, you know, people were not able to get to sit in positions like editors and so on. You know that, you know, you've highlighted this in the plays. But there was acknowledgement of the talent and just the magnificence and the brilliance of the kind of writing, some of the works that came out of Cantembers and Blokes. And it was just something that I think we are yet to explore enough of.
Yeah, absolutely. But excuse me, we must not forget also that it is the period where the government was becoming more vicious.
Yes.
Apartheid was still very fresh, officially in 1948. So there was an element of resistance.
Mm.
So with resistance comes being more assertive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think they were also becoming more conscious of expressing themselves, of using every available platform, be it music, be it literature, be it journalism, to assert their voices.
Mm. The complexity then that arises in that environment at that time with the assertion of their brilliance themselves is also the dynamic of a sense of almost rejecting one's own language and culture and heritage. That in itself also being quite an interesting dynamic right at the beginning of apartheid's, you know, I would say quite heavy hand on the South African black public.
Mm. Yeah, actually you have to look at, you know, at the background of most of these characters. Blok Modisani, amongst the drum guys, was just about the only one. I mean, when I'm talking about the kid guys, if you look at your Nat Nagasa,
yes,
Louis Ngosi,
yes,
Eski Mphahlele,
yeah,
Ken Temba, and them.
Yeah.
Most of them came from elsewhere.
Yes.
All right. Ngosi from the Natal, Ken Temba and Mphahlele from Marabastad. Nagasa also from Natal.
Yeah.
So they had to establish a new culture, you know, and reading was central in it.
Mm.
Reading was central in it, and their writing, I mean, the likes of Todd Matshikiza,
yes,
for instance, had to introduce a new style of writing. They called his Machikais, you know. So there was a new idiom altogether. There is not what I can call Sophiatown culture that they found in existence.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys had to say, this is who we are,
mm-hmm,
and formulate a new idiom,
mm-hmm,
you know, in that community. Yep.
Unfortunately, I mean, these stories don't end well. They're tragic, you know, in many ways. Obviously highlighting the brutality of the system at the time. And in a way for me, and I wonder what it is for you, a loss of what could have been in a way. I'm yearning to see at a different time, with different circumstances, what would have become of these great writers, these great thinkers, you know? I've got that at the back of my head. The back of my head.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate part. If you look, for instance, at someone like Ken Temba,
yeah,
Ken Temba tried to resist.
He
absolutely did not want to leave South Africa.
Mm.
And everything worked against him.
Mm.
He lost his job at Drum.
Mm.
He... Yeah, he was getting in trouble with the government when he wanted to travel, for instance. Mm-hmm. They refused him a passport. And as you all know, he later died in Swaziland in 1967. Blog Modisane, even though his circumstances differ, he left quite early with a greater vision compared to Ken Temba. I think Ken Temba felt compelled to leave.
Yeah.
Whereas Blok had plans.
Yes. The
first time he tried to leave was because he had gotten a scholarship.
Yes.
And of course, the application was declined.
Yeah.
And when he finally leaves, he lived longer in Europe and only dying in 1986.
Yeah.
You know. So, but as you could see in the plays, even though we're dealing with different eras, in as far as these characters are concerned, there is a connection.
Yeah.
I'll
leave it there as just to say, I mean, these are incredible pieces that you've put together. I'm assuming that they'll be back in our theatres again soon. I hope you're working on something.
Well, I hope they'll be back on stage. As you know, they have traveled quite extensively, but there has been interest in both of them to bring them back on stage.
But I mean, it's they are accessible now. The book is now available.
The book is now available, and really, I must say, it was largely, the demand from audiences, because after. For instance, nothing much was known about Blok Modisane's connection with Langston Hughes until I discovered those letters and wrote the play.
Yeah.
So many people were really interested in sitting and absorbing the plays in their own time. And the book is now available exactly for that reason.
And I think it's important, you know, we may not necessarily see it on big stages, but schools may put up the play, and all sorts of wonderful things may happen in the classroom when this is now accessible. So this is amazing. House of Truths and Blok and His American Bantu, two plays in one. It is published by Wits, am I right?
Wits University Press, that's correct.
By Wits University Press, and it is available at wonderful stores. And then we come to the second book. What a wonderful offering. So some of these I've already read before, which you've included here. Thank you for that. The Missing Pages short stories. The title obviously speaks to one of the short stories.
That's correct.
That that for me stands out, and of course, rightfully sits there at the very front. Speaks about also another time in South Africa where we were at war, actually, and I think we sometimes don't even, you know, pick out some of these, I suppose, landmarks that led us to the big apartheid era. But you handpick Saul Plaatje. I mean, just sort of, and it's a nice little cherry pick of who he was in a way, placing him at a very, very briefly at a time that speaks to him as a writer, his interests, and of course highlighting the era. When he was alive. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, in fact, I must credit Sabatampo Mugai for that story. He challenged me, knowing that I had reimagined the suit.
Yes.
You know, he said, can you do something about Saul Plaatje's The Mafeking Diary? The reason for that is which talks really about what was previously known as the Anglo-Boer War between 1899 to 1902. And, you know, for a long time, the Anglo-Boer War was believed to be just, as the name says, a war between
the two,
the Europeans of English descent and those of Afrikaans or the descendants of Dutch. You know, and so what Saul Plaatje did, he produced what is understood to be the very first war diary from
a black perspective.
A black perspective.
Yeah.
You know, which was very important because he saw the war differently, and he made he corrected some of the myths to believe that it was just the white community fighting amongst each other, whereas the inhabitants, the original inhabitants of the area, are not mentioned. So Sol Plaatje tells that story, and however. The first 7 days of the war are unaccounted for.
Are missing.
So this story is trying to fill those missing pages.
You deal with really wonderful complexities because, to your point about the fact that, yes, the understanding is that the rivals were the English and the Dutch descendants, which are now Afrikaans, were Afrikaans at the time. But also infiltration and black involvement, which is complex in itself, and how there are people who dissented, Africans who dissented and were part of this messy war and unfortunately also sold out their own.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I would agree with is the fact that black people did not start the war.
Yes.
And that black people were the victims of the war.
Yeah.
You know, the main victims were those who were not actively defending or attacking others, you know. So this is what Sol Plaatje made us aware of. And this is what the story is trying to highlight, that it's not only that it happened in their land, but their property was affected. The people themselves were affected by what was going on.
Their entire livelihoods
Absolutely.
Were affected. But I also think how important it was for narrative to transcend, and they knew that. And what was the efforts of both sides to influence narrative, I thought was very interesting. Told by the Africans.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is part of our peoples in as I would say literary historians to correct the misrepresentations of the past.
So the missing pages and the idea thereof, I think it's so sweet. I think your idea, I think your story of what happens to the missing pages, I think it is just, it's so beautiful. And it's beautiful because
someone said it's heartbreakingly beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's so naive and so honest. And so it really is such a beautiful account of, and I think for me what's important is that you humanize the black man.
Mm-hmm.
Because often, especially in the context of war, and when you try and make a point about a particular era, it's often the temptation is to create these heroes or war heroes and these magnificent characters that are you know, towering over nations and so on. But for me, what's beautiful about this is you just humanize the black man. He's human. He can forget. He can misunderstand. He's just human. And in the midst of war, people go about themselves and do whatever they want to do, and they remain who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, part of what I try to do when I develop my characters is to make them relatable.
Yes.
To be as human as possible.
Yeah. Yep. I could see a few people. I won't name those people. I could see just because all of us can be absent-minded. All of us can be a little ditzy. You know, all of us can just, you can just make silly mistakes and the implications thereof in the context of all of this. And how for some, it's unfathomable that you can be this normal human in the midst of all of this and still, your only reason is that I was just being human. You know, I made a mistake. I was just human. I just forgot something or whatever. But it's for you to read this text, and I think you're going to love it. I want us, you've just touched on what inspired you being given the challenge for the missing pages. And I want to go back to the lawsuit, because You do very well with responding to some of these short stories. And of course, it responds to the suit itself. Mm-hmm. Why was it important for yourself to respond to the suit?
As you know, I first responded to the suit with the suit continued.
Yes.
Look, on the one hand, it's me paying tribute to my predecessors.
Yes.
It's bringing attention to their work. Mm-hmm. That this is the work that inspires me. But also, for me, it's important to look at narratives from different perspectives. Mm-hmm. You would remember that the very first reimagination of the suit, that is the suit continued, was looking at the story from the perspective of the man that jumped out the window.
Yes.
And
that we don't talk about again in the original piece. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, so the lawsuit, really the character there, I was experimenting with what a blog most designer calls the unheroic hero.
Mm.
You know, you have a protagonist who is not necessarily, you know, above anyone else. You know, as you said in the previous story, who makes mistakes.
Yeah.
Who can
ordinary.
Be witty.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, who is as witty as some of the characters that we interact with on a daily basis.
And so does it concern you how the response is received?
Of course, I write to be read, and you know, it's always interesting for me to see how people respond to certain characters.
Mm-hmm.
But the response really does not affect the current work.
Mm-hmm.
It might affect how I conceive my future works.
Mm-hmm.
But responses always interest me because people never read the same stories the same way.
Mm.
And that's the exciting thing about writing.
One of my absolute favorite, it's Bonzi's Toe. And again, for me, I really, really say here that this is where your brilliance in short writing really shines, I have to say. And the question for me would be, so what makes a good short story?
Well, first of all, you must have a story to tell.
Yes.
All right. And then there are certain elements that you need to look at. Bonzi's Toe is one of those where I'm conscious of speaking in character.
Yes.
Because Bonzi's Toe is told from the perspective of a young boy.
Mm.
So you must speak like a young boy.
Yes.
The sentences are shorter.
Yes.
There's what you call the unity of action.
Yes.
You know, where the story is focused. As a result, it's like someone taking you by the hand.
Mm.
You're moving from point A to point B.
Mm.
But in that movement, you are not aware of where you are going.
Mm.
It's a journey of discovery.
Mm.
You know, so that is part of what I try to do when I write stories. There has to always be that element of surprise.
Mm.
It has to be a journey that you cannot pull out of. Once you embark in it, you somehow it has to take you along until boom, the surprise in the end.
You are limited by the amount of, you know, words you can use in a short story, time and all of that. I imagine, and I'm not sure, is it harder to write a short story than a full novel, for instance?
Yeah, a short story is harder in the sense that technically it's is very strict. You must be disciplined.
Yeah.
Every character you have in there must be there for a reason.
Mm.
You must use them optimally.
Yes.
All right. Even a character who emerges and disappears.
Yes.
They must have a specific role to play.
Mm.
You know, if, for instance, one story that I keep referring to as I teach short stories at UJ, The Suit.
Yes.
You see, The Suit, there are very few characters, but each one of them is used optimally.
Technically, I think Bonzi's toad does the same thing.
Yeah. So if you look at the suit, yeah. there's that character called Mapigela.
Yeah.
He emerges and disappears yeah. within a short space of time, but his presence
yeah.
makes a huge difference in the narrative,
mm.
you see. So that's what you find in Bonzi's toad also, is that every character that is there is used optimally,
mm.
you know. And you, there's what you call economy of words.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Yeah. Not a single
can't
word.
Waste.
Is,
you can't waste.
It's wasted.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And does it then bring you joy with the kind of restrictions that one is? I mean, you, as you said, you have to be quite disciplined. And I wonder. I mean, I know that those who write longer novels, they probably spend more time, I could be wrong, mulling over, you know, because the text is so much, they probably have more time to think it through, take it in, and all of that. Short stories, do you get the same kind of indulgence in...
Yeah.
in
Yeah, it challenges me. As a result, it gives me a lot of joy. I remember... when I was writing The Park Revisited.
Yes.
Which revisits, reimagines James Matthews's The Park.
Yes.
James Matthews was still alive at the time.
Oh.
And I shared the story with his daughter.
Yes.
And she was like, do you need this character? You know, and... I reread it and I was like, actually, this character...
So this was before the complete work?
Yes.
Oh,
so like this character can, you know, I mean, the story can still work without this character.
Huh.
So sadly, I had to...
rework it.
I had to rework it and omit that character.
Wow.
So short stories excite me in that sense that you have very few characters. As a result, you... establish a very intimate relationship with them.
Yeah.
You know, writing a story like The Asylum, for
yeah.
instance.
Yeah. Yes.
It's a story that's partly inspired by real life events,
mm-hmm.
but it's a story that really challenged me in terms of the short story discipline,
mm-hmm.
that I had to stick to the rules. Technically, you know, I had to know where is the hook.
Yes.
You know, at what point do I bring certain characters,
yes.
and to what extent do I use those characters?
Why did that in that particular short story, The Asylum, challenge you more than others?
Well, it's because partly that the story was conceived as a play.
Ah, I see.
You know, I conceived it as a play, but
and how do you know what story is a play and what should be a short story?
Strangely, my first professional play is The Suit. Mm. The House of Truth.
Yes.
And as I was researching on Ken Temba, you know, I just could see his life unfolding before me.
Got you.
You know, the same applies. I was in New York in 2012, 2013. Researching at the Beinecke Library, mm. At Yale University, and going through the letters between Bloch and Langston Hughes,
yeah.
I could visualize.
It had to be a play.
Yeah, it had to be a play. I knew at that very moment that this has to be a play. And this one, The Asylum, came to me quite differently.
Mm-hmm.
In 2022. And strangely, I was watching a comedy at the National Arts Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And then this thought came to my mind. And watching comedy, I started crying.
Mm.
You know, tears just started flowing from my eyes.
Mm.
And I knew that this is something that I need to write about.
Mm.
Yeah.
But this particular, The Asylum, then what changed? Deciding... to write a short play as opposed to the play?
Nothing changed. Look, for me to write, sometimes I some of my best stories are stories conceived at one moment,
yes,
but I let them simmer.
Got you.
As a result, most of those stories, I write them within one sitting. A story, for instance, like Bonzi's Toe, which again is based on real life incidents or inspired by real life incidents. It's a story that stayed with me from childhood that haunted me. And then when I finally decided to sit down and write it, I wrote it and finished in one sitting. The Asylum took slightly longer. I wrote it over 2 days. But again, it's a story that haunted me. And I knew I'm going to write it as a play.
So it will still be a play.
It will still be a play. Okay. I had to write this one. Okay. Like the book, The Missing Pages, is published in India. So they invited me, and when they asked me, do you have any new work that we could consider for publication? I said, yeah, for sure I do. And they said, okay, please send it. And I was like, okay, maybe
you can sneak the asylum. That's what I mean.
So that's what happened, and I wrote it over 2 days.
Wow. Yeah. So The Missing Pages, I know, published in India. Is it now readily available here?
It is.
Sort of.
Yeah, it's
You've
a limited.
You've got to know people.
It's a limited edition, so I'm launching both books on the 10th of April, yes. So they will be available.
All right. Yeah, limited, in other words, you've got finite number of copies available in stores.
Yeah, very few copies are available at the moment.
Okay, but can they find it at Suela's shop, maybe?
Yes.
All right. So we usually tell you where to find the books. It's in 44, no, not 44 Stanley. It's at 27 Boxes.
27 Boxes, Melville.
Yeah. And the store is Book Circle Capital.
Yes.
And so you can at least go there. And I guarantee you, if you can't find the book there, ask them. They'll get the book for you. So my guest this evening is Pure. You said you are going to be launching when?
On the 10th of April at the University of Johannesburg, Nadine Godima Room.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Spur, thank you. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for sharing this wonderful work with us. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we'll go on our social media platforms. We'll give you the list of the books. And as I said, Book Circle Capital. It's in Melville, 27 Boxes. If they don't have the copies, just ask them. They will make sure that you get a copy. It's 10 o'clock. I'll be back tomorrow at 8.
Click kaya959.co.za. This is how we do it. To download the Point of View podcast.